Okay, you can say your thing now.
Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Sync for the 29th of March. Let's start on RFCs. Let's start with stuff that's already pending, and then we'll cover some of the new stuff. Let's start with 82, which is explicit partial calls, which we have marked ready for vote.
Nice.
I thought that you're doing pretty well already. And then Insanity Bit left a nice comment about, what was that, 4 days ago, pointing out that actually exactly what we're talking about is similar to Ruby and Rust for this stuff. And that's good, right? So I vote yes. Anyone else?
I you know, I don't care enough to have it be anything other than that. So sure. Yeah. I'm good for it.
Cool.
I approve.
Excellent.
You approve of your idea.
Very good. Okay, I'm just gonna
merge my rendering of Sylvan's idea.
All right, here we go. Merge. It has been merged. For the merging, it has happened.
Theo, you've been handling adding the issues for that. Are you going to take care of that one?
Yep.
Cool.
Awesome. Awesome.
That means I can close this window and not have to worry about it anymore.
All right, let's look at number 86, exhaustive match, which is listed as final comment period, but I think this is basically ready to go. Everyone just keeps clicking thumbs up, which, yeah, me too, right? Like, I'm click that too. So I'm thinking we should just merge this.
I'm okay with that.
All right, cool.
I'm so excited for this one.
Yeah, me too.
We all are. We're like, yeah, there's a process we normally go through, but yeah.
I mean, hell, you know, I'll make it look like we went through a process. Here we go.
Well, everybody, we now have proof that we didn't. So,
ready for vote. There we go. I vote yes. Look, merge. I've been writing code that currently does not work in the expectation that it soon will.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. And looks like nobody's had any other than Joe, other than Joe's comment, which led to the thing which I need to play around with of, you know, for a way to test FFI call things so that we could plug stuff in. Other than that, I mean, there's been no comments on this. I think it's
ready for vote, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be fine to merge. I just kind of wanted to bring up, like, the idea in general, not necessarily as a blocker for this RFC.
Yeah, no, it was great because it was actually something I've been thinking about for a little while, too, of this whole, the way the FFI calls are really hard for this, and they're embedded in there. And I tried rewriting TCP connection once, and that turned into a nightmare, actually. So the next thing, it was not just there, but it was, like, in general for, like, doing fault injection, it would be great if you could swap out like FFI calls. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think that is still a thing I need to have a chance to play around with, but yeah, I got distracted. So.
All right. Gonna merge. Here we go.
Yep. And I mean, I already have an implementation of that. So Theo, when you create it, just slap my name on it.
Gotcha.
All right, and number 87, which is RFC for serialized.signature, which isn't marked for anything yet.
I don't think I checked this one out yet.
So this is basically about producing a hash of the program that says, essentially, can we deserialize what you have serialized?
Yeah, so it's not so much for like it doesn't solve the problem of you still shouldn't deserialize from an untrusted source from a security standpoint, but it will save you, or rather, it gives you the tools to save yourself from like a misconfiguration or an accidental deserialization of data from a different binary.
Yep.
So not really a security fix so much as just like giving you a tool to prevent an accident.
Yeah.
So the unresolved question there is, what is the best way to generate the signature? I mean, one way to do it would just be a random sequence on every compile, but obviously it would be a bit nicer if it were deterministic, so that way
you can random sequence would produce non-deterministic builds for all Pony programs, and so, I don't want that.
I would agree with that statement. On the other hand, right now I cannot compile the same Pony source code 2 times in a row and send serialized objects between them with no changes to them whatsoever. It still ends up being different so that it blows up.
It should not be.
It should not be. Okay. All of these things are remembrances from working way too long during periods of times when things blew up. Okay. So then my only problem is I would like it so that if the type doesn't change at all, but the build does, that you could still use them. But that's a different RFC entirely.
Yeah. So this is actually, having this as an initial pass is no bad thing, but it does bring up the issue of what does this look like in the long run in terms of serialization, and is there, particularly when we start talking about a REPL and serialization where types are added, and then we say, well, can this REPL talk to that REPL? And when they have types that are logically the same, they should be able to exchange them. And that, yeah, that's a thing. It's a little bit tricky in terms of hashing the binary because you run into the usual problem, which is I hash the binary and I put that in my binary.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's the classic like attacker the issue with trying to generate the same. Yeah.
Yeah. So. But,
go ahead.
So one approach is to say that because the thing is, since you want it to be deterministic, generally speaking, a hash is what you want. Now, this isn't supposed to be cryptographic, so it's not like it needs to be very strong, but it needs to be strong enough. Like, it can't be an ADLER32 or a CRC or something like that, because you will get collisions when you didn't expect them, and things will go terribly wrong. So another thing we could do is look at having a deterministic order of modules and say that we actually hash the AST.
Would we really need... Go ahead.
That's a bit tricky, and it probably... The thing about hashing the AST is that then small changes to the source code that aren't meaningful aren't in the hash. And then it's different from hashing the source code, right? But you were going to say something. What was that?
Well, what I don't know enough about how serialization is implemented to know how practical or reasonable this is, but one thing I was thinking about is not hashing the entire program AST, but like hashing the things that influence serialization. So that would be basically you'd want to hash the type descriptors and the type definition of each one of those types. And I'm not sure whether the types that can be serialized are they bounded at compile time to where the compiler knows which types you're using serialization with, or are they not?
They're not.
Okay. So then it's basically effectively you'd be hashing the entire AST except for maybe the top level structures. So.
However, you saying that makes me think that maybe there's another approach that we could use, which is the thing that really matters isn't the AST at all, but the LLVM representation. And in fact, if I serialize a type and then I want to deserialize it and my version of that type has different methods, different implementations for the method, all of this stuff, that doesn't actually matter.
Yeah, because that's not getting serialized.
That's not getting serialized. The thing that gets serialized is the representation, and we need to maintain So that means things like what's the type ID, so that we can find the type descriptor to plug it in when we deserialize it, and what's the underlying representation. And now that starts to sound quite fun in a compiler hack-wittery way, which I'm generally in favor of.
Can I put one thing back into your thinking?
Yeah.
There should be landing soon the actual implementation of an RFC that was open for a long period of time for changes to serialization to allow you to hook other languages that you might be working with inside your binaries, like say C++ or something like that, uh-huh, into the serialization mechanism so that they would be being serialized as well. Just want to remind you that that's coming soon in case it influences your thinking at all.
That's very interesting. So I think that if we treated the representation of a type as the same under those circumstances, it wouldn't know about the serialization code, but there's a method for that, right?
Yes.
There's
a magic special method that you, as somebody who are creating these objects in another language, can implement. Yes.
Well, then I think that's quite interesting, because then we could say, okay, it really is just about the LLVM representation. Plus, if it has a serialized method, a hash of the actual AST of the serialized method, where nothing can change. And if it at the AST level, if it does, we have to assume that this means something different.
And then also plus, if there's platform specific stuff that influences, I think platform-specific stuff influences serialization, right? Because it influences how the...
Right. And in fact, that's good in the sense that a 32-bit thingy, a 32-bit version of the program, until slash unless we write the code to handle variable widths, won't know how to deserialize something that uses a U-size to a 60, that was encoded by a 64-bit program. Now, we can look at that, but it does raise thorny issues. For example, the 5 billion element array that's serialized by a 64-bit program and then deserialized by a 32-bit program.
I just wanted to bring up that we needed to add that into the hash.
Yeah. Well, technically we wouldn't, right? Because there would be a different hash for the underlying LLVM encoding, because one would have a 64-bit field and one would have a 32-bit field.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if... Okay. I wasn't sure if talking about hashing that already had a specific stuff applied to it.
Yeah, I'm thinking actually going for the underlying LLVM encoding at a level, so that we're actually putting
not
together...
Not the LLVM IR, but the what LLVM understands the structure to be on that platform.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, we wouldn't try and like extract the IR, but basically as we are building the thing, we're also building how LLVM sees it. And in basically in gen type, we can go, well, the structure looks like this. And I think the most complicated thing there is trying to make sure that a type ID is constant, as constant as we can make it across builds, even as types are added and removed from the program. I think that's
That's what Sean might have run into earlier with talking about how he experienced problems with compiling the same code with no changes twice and not having to really talk to it. There might already be some form of non-determinism in those type ID assignment process or something else in there.
That's a good point. There may well be based on memory addresses that in the string table. Oh, we should destroy that.
That would be why we have that problem. Yes. I was like, I'm pretty sure we have that problem. I think so, but it came from periods of extreme tiredness.
Does Benoit's new unnamed address change fix that?
No, sadly.
Okay. All right. Just check it.
Yeah, it's a good, all those things are worth checking. So I think having relatively static type IDs would give us the whole, along with this approach, would give us much more consistent deserialization. And ideally, we would try to get it to the point where even programs that are quite different but happen to use the same type would be able to serialize and deserialize that type to each other.
Yeah.
Which gives you the, I use this package, you use this package, why can't we serialize and deserialize types from this package to each other? Well, ideally we could.
Well, but okay, the problem there is that you're, when the signature is being generated for the entire program, it doesn't know what types you're serializing and deserializing, so.
Oh, sure, but the idea would be that for that type, you would get something, a consistent hash for that type. So when you serialize that type and it says, it's this type, and by this type, I mean here, this thing, then when you go and deserialize it, you go, oh, I know what that is. It's one of these.
Right, okay. So, but yeah, in that situation, you wouldn't be depending on the serialized signature to be the same, right?
Right, and in fact, you wouldn't use that. That would be the next. That's either the next level thing or replacing this idea of a single signature is the per type signature that gives you the flexibility.
Yeah, and one thing I was thinking about, I don't know if it. I was trying to avoid a solution that added extra overhead onto serialization itself. Because the idea would be you just check the signature and then you assume, okay, I can talk to. I can receive any data that was produced by this other program safely if the signature is the same as mine.
Yeah.
And there's no extra overhead on the per serialization basis. But I think what you're talking about probably would be extra overhead per serialization.
So this the overhead would be that we would probably want something longer than 64 bits. As it encoded as the type ID. And then instead of looking up in a contiguous storage to get the type descriptor based on the type ID, you would look up in a map to get the type descriptor based on the type ID. That would be the overhead.
Yeah, I don't know if that's acceptable for use cases like Sean's or not. I don't know.
I mean, we could probably get away with a 64-bit type ID. I mean, this is not supposed to be cryptographic, right? This is supposed to be useful. And if you want more complex cryptographic checks, that's another level that we could talk about doing. And of course, they're always fakeable, right? Some program could report that it has some hash that it does not have. So, yeah, I mean, we could even use 64 bits, and then it becomes actually, we could actually do better than well, either we do it as a hash map that we build, or we do it as, we generate a function that is essentially a big switch statement, and then let the compiler worry about optimizing from there, where it has a collection of jump tables and binary searches. Compilers are incredibly well optimized for switch statements like that. So actually code genning a function that turns a type ID into a type descriptor might be a really nice way to go there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Then the overhead is not bad, actually. Not bad? How's that? For we haven't measured, so I don't really know.
Okay. So it sounds like this idea would be a general, like, it would, if we implemented this in the way you're talking about, it would remove the need for the serialized signature that this RFC opens, right?
Yeah, it would.
And I guess the deserialization process would just become like a partial function or, a union that could return an error that gave you something.
Yeah. I mean, we could even figure out a way to talk about building something that was a self-describing blob so that if something had some specific LLVM representation, we would build as compact a bit string as possible to represent that thing. and encode that so that it was actually self-describing. So you can say, I think I'm one of these in terms of type ID, and my encoding is like this. But I think that's probably more than we need, as long as we had some really useful type ID hash type thing that knew how to, that included some concept of that representation. All of that is to say, this RFC is also totally fun and might be a nice initial step.
Yeah, we still need a way to generate the hash though for the programs. We haven't really.
Yeah.
That by combining the hashes of all the types in the program under that scheme you're talking about. And at that point, we might as well go the extra mile, it seems like.
Yeah, that's a good point, because it is actually kind of tricky to talk about what that looks like otherwise. I mean, we could talk about saying, well, we generate the LLVM module. And somehow over the contents of that module, we get a hash.
I mean, the other thing would be determining which types are reachable through serialization, like if the compiler were more involved. I guess right now, I believe it's just an FFI call to some C code that does a serialization. And if the compiler were treating that as magic, it could say, okay, what types have I seen get serialized? And I'm assuming that only those types would get deserialized.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Anyway, we should probably move on to something else.
Okay. Right now, it takes an any box rather than being parameterized. We could say that we could change it so that serialization is parameterized over some type box, and then you have to specify, and then those are the things, but it seems like, I'm not sure. That might be a way to do that. Because what I want to avoid is saying, oh, you have to say that you have some serializable trait, because that's just incredibly annoying. There's always going to be something that you would like to serialize that didn't have it, and you can't go backfit it. But if it was classVal serialized over some A, which is any box, then when you instantiate serialized, it would be over some specific type.
Yeah, that's more or less what I was picturing, but again, I'm not sure if that is.
Yeah.
And that's worth the extra trouble.
Yeah. Okay. On that happy note, that was good conversation. Well, I think we should come back and revisit this, but let's move on to the next thing, which is pull requests.
And we have lots of things that are backed up right now, sadly.
Oh, okay.
Travis is a little unhappy.
Yeah.
We have Gordon's one here for experimental support for building VS2017 on Windows that he opened a couple of days ago. And he's on it. He said that it works for him. This is issue for anybody who's listening. It's 1739. He asked on the dev mailing list, but nobody responded. So it seems like a reasonable thing to merge. And
absolutely. Yeah. I actually looked over this when he added it, and what he's doing makes perfect sense. He's just extended some of the stuff that spelunks around Windows looking for registry values and things like that to understand 2017. 2017 is still in preview, so I think a lot of people are not installing it at this point. I know.
Actually, it's out.
Sorry?
It's out in general release now.
Oh, 2017 is in general release?
Way yep. to be a good Microsoft employee, Sylvan.
I'm the worst. That is terrible. Oh, that's excellent. When did it come out?
March 4th or something like that. So.
Oh, wow. I'm like literally weeks out of date. That's pretty bad. Let's merge this. Whee!
And of course, they changed all the everything completely.
Yeah.
It was tricky to get it working.
There you go. Well, merged. There you go. Well, I might actually have to go install 2017 on my workbox. there you go. Cool. So there's one on here, 1752, use a constant time algorithm for trait subtyping tests. I'm still worried about this. I know that Benoit wrote back saying that he thinks the matrix is fine under a JIT scenario, and he says he'll do some benchmarking, so that's really good. And we'll find out. But just so that people know why I'm worried about this, is that ending up with a dense matrix for a subtyping test is, generally speaking, considered the worst outcome for dynamic type checking. And like, there's a lot of stuff in the literature on how do you avoid the dense matrix. And currently, the way Pony does it is it says, okay, well, we're going to just list the things that we know we are a subtype of. And it does a linear search on those, which could easily be replaced with a binary search, right? Which would drop it from ON to O log N. And that would already be a huge win. And compared to the dense matrix, I think I'm much happier with an O log N. And then saying, oh, well, we could take it the other way, and we could say we're not going to encode it that way, and say we're going to encode it the other way. For every trait type, we're going to encode all concrete types, which are subtypes, and build a function. This is the comment that I left. Means that you can build the compiler efficient switch statement, where it's a combination of jump tables and binary search that the compiler generates depending on what's efficient. And the compiler then gets really aggressive about understanding when is linear search more aggressive, more effective than binary search, and all the things that happen with switch statements, which are one of the most heavily optimized things in compilers. Which would also give us, under the JIT scenario, function pointers that would be pretty straightforward to replace as new types were added. Anyway, that's my thinking. I know Benoit's going to do some testing, which is awesome. And I feel bad being negative about his approach, because his approach does give O1 dynamic subtyping testing, which is cool, but I think in the long run problematic. Anyway, does anyone else have stuff they want to say on that? Or
yeah, I would just say that I would want to make sure that it's something that if the benchmarking looks like it's looking good for it, I'd like to try running it on some larger programs.
Yeah.
Since I've been working a little bit on the sort of Pony compiler and Pony core, and that's going to be quite a large program.
That's going to be a big damn program. I mean, even running it on Acolyte would be pretty cool. By the way, if people haven't seen Acolyte, it's a roguelike written in Pony, and you should go compile and play that, because it's a damn roguelike written in Pony. Like, that's self-recommending. And that's a fairly hefty little chunk of Pony too, actually. And would be interesting to have a look at. Okay. So there we go. So in other things in PR world, oh, thank you, Sean. Sean slapped a do not merge on that, which I think is a good idea. We should get some tests on it.
How about 1575? I'm unclear of where it's at this point in time.
Yeah, me too, to be honest.
And I don't think Dippin is either. Like, is the end result of the last one for, hey, we're going to merge this, or from, it's like a sync call from 28 days ago? I'm unclear on that.
So, the idea that Joe had was to say that instead of having a block size and an OSX block size, that you would have you would have packages that were by platform, so that you would do there would be a POSIX block size, but there would also be an OSX block size. And so, right, so POSIX would only be, sorry, I said that wrong. There would be, because block size differs amongst POSIX platforms, there wouldn't be a POSIX block size, there would be a Linux block size and an OSX block size. So.
And it would force you to use them within an ifdef Linux and ifdef OSX.
Right.
The fact that it was missing in the POSIX package lets you know that you're doing something wrong if you're using POSIX dot something, if you're not within an ifdef POSIX.
Right. Yeah. It seems a shame to hold this up too much, in the sense that this is a pretty contained chunk of work that isn't going to break things. And it was my dumb idea to put OSX on the types in the first place, which I think slowed Dippin down, which, sorry about that, Dippin, that's my fault. Yeah, I mean, some of these, I'm...
Yeah, so I think at this point, he's waiting for direction on whether to close this or other updates he should be making. That's my takeaway from that there.
I mean, yeah, I think we're at like a little bit of an impasse, because I guess the solution that Dippin or I would be happy with, Sylvan doesn't like, and the solution that Sylvan or I would be happy with, Dippin doesn't like.
What's the one that I don't like?
Having type, being able to put the if def on the type declaration.
Only if we can continue to type check for all types, for all platforms when we type check.
Yeah, well, I think we explored that and we didn't have a good way to.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm not trying to pin it on you. Like the fact.
No. I just said literally just forgotten.
I've brought it up multiple times as well, and Sylvan always brings that up, and I'm like, oh yeah, right. It in various other things.
Yeah.
I mean, it is valuable to know that if it compiles on your, if a Poneke program compiles on your platform, it'll compile on others.
Oh yeah.
It may not work on others, but
right. But at least it'll damn type check. Yeah.
And I do agree that it's a valuable aspect to it. It's just that, yeah.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to become dogmatic about that, right? Like if this is something where we go, but to support, what we're talking about is to support specific POSIX types for very low level stuff in packages where we're going to be exposing some pony level interface afterwards anyway. And we don't want people to be using these types in general across their program, right? We really don't. And so I would hate to mess this up for Pony as a whole to make it more like C, when I don't really want it to be more like C.
Yeah, I think that's a compelling argument. So, I think Dippin did have some concerns about the per if def platform approach as well. So,
yeah.
I mean, the solution that everybody agrees on is one that we can't implement yet, because it takes a lot of work to use, you know, figure out what libclang would integrate with to solve this problem and figure out what that looks like and implement it. And that's kind of a huge feature as well.
Yeah. And actually is still a bit on the problematic side. in terms of just being able to do things like find a header file is really tough. Really tough. And if we start getting into, well, you're going to have to pass include directories on the command line to the compiler in order to compile, I really don't want Pony compiles to end up like that. That would be sad.
Yeah, there's a lot of really hairy aspects to it that need to be ironed out before we even find that it's feasible.
Yeah.
Including, like, what happens, okay, we looked up in C, we found the definition. Now what do we do? If we find that this, you know, POSIX type is equivalent to U-size, if it's equivalent to I-32 on one platform and equivalent to I-64 on another, then, and we were to just blindly define it as, you know, at the if-def level, we run into the same set of problems, I guess I should say. Unless we were to define it as kind of a distinct type that is not equivalent to I-32 or I-64, and say that you have to explicitly convert, basically would be creating a new machine word type that you have to explicitly convert to and from every time you want to use it.
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep. That stuff, it gets even crazier with structs, where you're saying, well, struct stat is one of my favorite examples, because everyone says struct stat, well, that's cross-platform. You can just use struct stat on anything. Well, you can.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've used that. No, you can't.
Yeah. It only kind of feels like you ought to be able to. And
it looks the same until you try to use it in different places.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, it's kind of just a common FFI nightmare that C APIs that are designed to be used by C are not as easy to use as C APIs that are designed to be used by FFI.
Right.
Because there's a ton of things that the C-oriented APIs expect that your compiler will know at compile time, and you don't have to write it in your program like you do in FFI.
Right. Exactly so. And, you know, another place we could go with this, just to throw it out there, is that Python has been incredibly successful at including tools for building C FFI libraries as part of deploying a Python project. And that's something we could look at. We could look at saying, oh, look, if you put together a C FFI library following these very strict rules, much like Python, then we will understand how to compile it alongside Pony. And then we can produce a C library and link against it. And when you have this stuff that is very specific, then you can write C and do that. You know, that's a thing. I don't like that thing, but it is a thing.
Yeah. I mean, it would be nice to have kind of a way to make it easy for somebody to write a C library that Pony knows how to compile, like using libclang, you know, or at least be able to. I mean, because you can link against them now. It's just a little bit of a hassle when you have to expect the C compiler to be there and all that stuff.
Yeah.
First giant feature added to Pony stable.
We all chuckled nervously.
Half joke, half serious.
I was just laughing nervously there.
Well, you know, I mean, yep. Okay, anyway, sorry. Sorry to put the fears in everyone.
You made the fear. So, that said, maybe we should look into how Rust does this. Generally speaking, Rust makes really good design decisions, and they are trying to replace C, not depend on C, which is fantastic. And so they're going to have POSIX type issues of this kind. So maybe we ought to look at that. Maybe the interesting place to check.
I think it would be good to look and see how they do it. If we don't get any new ideas from that, I guess what it helps, like what I would like to see done with this PR is just to do the per platform sub packages. But I know Dippin had some, he had some concerns about that. So, you know, maybe I or someone else would have to pick it up to finish it out. I don't know.
As far as I can tell, from the Rust documentation, they have some deep namespacing stuff where it's libc types os arch POSIX 01 block size t. And it claims in the documentation that that just says type block size t equals i64. But I suspect what that actually is that Rust is not type checking all platforms.
Well, it sounds like it sounds like they're doing the sub package thing, like I was suggesting.
So their packages are not based on OS X or something like that. They're based on versions of POSIX. So they're making one that's very similar. So for example, there's libc types os common POSIX 01 and libc types os arch POSIX 01. So for common, it has the things that are actually the same. And then in the arch one, it has theoretically the stuff that might be different by platform.
When you were saying arch, I thought you were using that as like a substitute the real architecture view.
That would absolutely make sense, but isn't what I meant.
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. Here, let me post the link to the Rust stuff with the general comment of thank you, Rust, for being very often good at these things. And maybe people can have a look and we can see if that is in any way helpful. I don't know. So they talk about how these bindings are architecture and libc specific. So what they don't do, what they specifically don't do, is type check types per platform. All platforms. They type check for the current architecture and platform only.
Yeah, okay.
Which, you know, there are reasons for that, and maybe I should give up on being dogmatic about this, and maybe that's what we should do.
Well, I don't know. I kind of agree with your arguments, and so like among the two solutions that I think are like from a design point of view acceptable, like I do think that the sub package is better for that reason because I think your concerns are valid.
Okay. Yeah. So I think these Rust docs are pretty interesting, and if people have time to read them, I think that'd be pretty cool.
Just the link you posted. Hi. This is the libc package that is distributed with the compiler, which is not what most people use.
Do they use the crates one?
Yeah. Okay. Like the recommended approach is to use the crates one, which.
Okay. Well, let's have a look at how that works.
This is the link. I think it's like more or less similar, but they've changed the crates one since to be like more like easy to use.
Cool.
But it is, like you said, they only type check the current platform.
Right.
And not others.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, it looks like the this link that you sent is containing a separate sub package for each platform.
Yeah. Looking.
No, this is just basically they compile the package on every platform and then they post the docs of the result compile on that platform.
Yeah. But
they had to compile it like 20 times to get the 20 docs.
And then you can include whichever crate you want or something, or I don't understand.
The crate has all of the code, if deft, and when you compile, you'll get just for yours.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
So okay. It's the let's if def the types and not worry about the fact that you can't type check across platforms.
Yeah, I see. So no users are ever using, they're never referencing in their code a platform specific libc. They're always referencing just the libc, and they're getting implicitly the correct
exactly.
one. Their
platform. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Before we go down that route, right? If we go down that route, I would want to also then open that up to the discussion of, how do you say it, muscle or whatever? Is that how it is, the other libc? I mean, yep. If we start going down that route, then I think that we should make sure that, you know, we take that into account as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have ifdefs for muscle as well.
Yeah, I noticed that on there. I was like, aha, yep, got this, right.
And so then they have, like, a wrapper, which is called Nix, which is, like, platform independent, like anything POSIX more or less, that wraps around libc.
Right, and just doesn't define the things that differ so that you don't use them by accident.
Well, so you're not meant to use, I've not used Nix a lot, but you're not meant to use the lower level ones. Like Nix provides wrappers where you don't use the lower level type.
Oh, right, yeah, sure. Yeah,
it's just like Rust friendly types on top of that.
Yeah, kind of like our pony underscore helper functions that we expose as part of the compiler as like.
Actually, I would say that this is even higher level than that. That's
well, nicer than that, yeah.
Well, in the sense of it's more like primitives that have all the FFI stuff encapsulated.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I just meant that we currently expose some FFI functions that have platform independent type signatures and then do platform dependent stuff inside them.
Yeah. Via the runtime library. Yeah.
Yeah. Via the runtime library. But obviously, yeah, it would be better if that were just like a package that had, you know, that code in Pony instead of in C. But
yep. Okay.
So I guess that raises the question, do we want, kind of a higher level question of, do we want to do this foreign types thing at all? Like, do we want to sort of encourage or facilitate the use of platform specific types in Pony code, or do we kind of want to discourage that and try to abstract anything POSIX related they want to do and also the Windows equivalents, and into primitives in the standard library and expect people to use those instead?
I think the latter is definitely what we want to do. I mean, in much the same sense that C++ has put massive effort into eliminating those very fiddly platform-specific things that used to dominate C and C++ code and try as much as possible to have things like standard thread and standard mutex.
Also, Rust has been discussing adding something called scenario, where it's basically you have to enable, say, I allow my code to depend on like Linux-specific APIs or POSIX-specific APIs, and then the compiler will error if you've not enabled the POSIX or the Linux flag. They're not doing it yet, but this is one thing they've been talking about.
That's interesting. That would be on a per crate basis, so that you'd have a crate that does that as opposed to a program.
Well, so you'd basically every time you use a platform specific API, you'd have to whitelist it. And so you'd have one crate which provides an abstraction over all the platform specific APIs. So that crate whitelists its users of the platform specific stuff. Yeah. Then higher level users cannot accidentally use the platform specific API.
Right. So it's per crate. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in some sense, Pony, in a funny way, it doesn't do that in the sense of that specific mechanism, but it does do that in the sense of FFI as a whole, where it says, no, you're really supposed to wrap up your FFI, because then you have the concept of safe packages, where if you really want to make sure that your code isn't FFI dependent all over the place, you can just say only these packages are allowed to use FFI. And at that point, you sort of have to trust them, and away they go. So that's not totally dissimilar to that idea in Rust. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, well, except Rust is not on an FFI level. It's more on like specific. You can choose one function, even if it's a Rust function, to be like only Unix, and then people must opt in to be allowed to use it.
Yep.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Same idea.
Yeah, I mean, in the same sense, Pony can. You could have a package that just had private types that dealt with that kind of stuff, and then you expose a public type, which gives you the platform independent Pony interface, right? It's not exactly the same, but it's that same idea of let's make sure that people aren't bit twiddling in their program as a whole, which is a good thing. Okay. I've baffled, and why did I say baffled? Babbled about this for far too long.
I have a couple things I'd like to
cool
do quickly. One, issue 1671, right? This is where we're on GitHub pages and we can't do SSL, et cetera. Netlify offers free hosting for open source projects, which would allow us to take care of that and potentially pick up some other features. Wanted to see if anybody had any objections to switching off of GitHub pages to Netlify.
None at all.
So if not, then I'm going to assign myself to that as sync discussion says Netlify is good. They have some other additional things, but I don't really know much about it. But hey, like supporting HTTPS would be good. People come in periodically every now and then and mention that. And it's just a nice thing to do. So,
yeah. And just so that people know, in general, Netlify is not a small thing. There's quite a bit of fairly decent-sized projects that are now hosted on Netlify, things like Lodash and Kubernetes and things like that.
Yeah, serverless, Yarn.
Yeah, so it's unlikely to go away tomorrow. You never can tell with this stuff. It could go away next year, but it wouldn't be...
What we're doing with GitHub pages anyway is we're just pushing the source there. So yeah. The change...
It could easily be pushed somewhere else.
Yeah, is basically we have the account. We push the stuff that Travis creates there instead. We update a little bit of DNS and we should be good.
Cool.
We should be good. Sweet. So I had one other question for a thing, which... As we're almost right at the end here, for a question of when did we switch off of having all of the strings be null terminated? Does anybody remember?
I can go find the PR.
Do you know if it was before or after December of last year?
Should have been before.
Okay, so can we open up 1483 for a moment then?
Yeah.
So this is a weird GC goes kaboom, bad access error, right? Under load, okay? The source code for this includes the usage of strings that are coming from elsewhere, right? Which go through env out, which we did find a memory buffer problem with this morning. So I think it would be worth asking people to try and test this one again and see if we might have found where our weird-ass issue that none of us could understand where it was coming from was coming from.
Cool.
Reasonable? Yeah.
Very. Yeah.
It sounds logical because, I mean, it's talking about something is stomping on memory under a high load. Well, you'd need, you know, so that could very well be it, I think. Yep.
I also pushed a change... recently? When was this? Let me find...
I just confirming that this would have, it's at least prior, it's definitely prior to December 2016.
Okay. Yeah, because this was opened on December 23 of 2016.
Yeah, because I'm seeing that there were several other string trim related stuff that happened. Let's see, August, October, November. So yeah, it.
Yeah. Okay.
It would have been yeah.
So 5 days ago, I pushed PR 1754, which may also fix some of these. I don't know about that one, but it is a memory related thing, which is that we were not recursing when we needed to, when something that was isolated is now seen as val during a send. We were doing it on mark, but we weren't doing it on send.
Yeah. So yeah, I was just going through the things we have as on discuss at sync, right?
Cool.
That we never took that off from whenever the last time that went on there was, right?
Yeah.
I see why I put it on and then I didn't take it off after the thing. Reason why I put it on turned out not to be the case, but then it was in front of my face and I was like, oh, wait. But let me, and I was, while we were talking, I'm looking at the code going, are we doing out? Oh, look, oh, we are. Oh, well, that could be a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. We have a bunch more that are on here, but we're also kind of at the end of the hour. So I think we could pick those up another time. We have 12 that are open for a needs discussion at sync.
Okay.
But I think, you know, well, some of those could be some later point in time. There's fun ones like Fedora. Apparently you have to link with L Atomics and stuff. So there's some figuring out what, go read 1756 sometime when you have the time.
It's going to make me cry, isn't it?
But, well, no, if you really want to cry, go look at 1625.
What if I don't want to cry?
Well, you're going to have to cry eventually, because eventually we're going to have to look at it and figure out why this person, when they start up a pony program that does nothing, it uses 50% of their CPU.
That would be bad.
Windows, or why this person on Linux gets a different thing, but gets really high CPU usage for something where it runs a timer that fires every like 5 milliseconds.
Huh.
So, but yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, but I don't know. We've gone.
Maybe next week we should start with issues, since we always start with RFCs and then pull requests. Maybe next week we should start with issues and try and
get just a bunch. Bang through. Guess so that there's a bunch that I haven't even marked as needs discussion for sync, which are also just sitting hanging out there. So yeah, I mean we're up to like. Okay. 116, okay, three of those are recently done RFCs and there's a release one, but it's a reasonable number there to like,
yeah,
start like bang, like, hey, can't compile with Mac ports, some questions around Moodle, blah, blah, blah. You know, lots of those, hey, it would be really nice to come up with some kind of answers for these because they're coming from people who I think got interested in the Pony stuff. A lot of them came in like, since I pushed stuff out there to promote the community survey last year, that resulted in a bunch of new stuff coming in. It's like a lot of those look like it's like people who got interested around that time who ran into problems installing or whatnot. So it'd be good to work through some of those.
Okay, cool.
The one thing we haven't done for this one so far is if anybody who's not on the core team has anything they wanted to bring up, we should probably do that.
I'm just wondering on the tuple not being objects subject. Joe opened a new issue today, which is kind of related to that. But I remember reading a comment from Sylvan a while ago. I just wanted to know if there was any like change on.
There hasn't been. Planning. There hasn't been. Okay. So some of the stuff that it's outstanding. I know Benoit had some approaches where he thought maybe we didn't need to encode tuples as objects. But yeah, so I do think on the other hand that, the tuples of unions versus unions of tuples scenario should be resolved in the favor of a tuple is a distinct type. And so a tuple of unions is not the same as some union of tuples that could theoretically be a subtype of it. in other words, treat them as a more concrete structural type, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
At which point we may find that blowing 8 bytes on slapping an object header in there just makes our lives easier. So it's still something that's open. And were you looking at it from a formal point of view or an implementation point of view? Both?
Yeah. So for the moment, I've kind of ignored tuples completely.
Yeah.
Because they made the type system quite a lot of, like, a bunch of edge cases. and I've got enough of these at the moment.
Yes.
So it's also because, so at the moment, I'm just considering any hash, any to be like a top type, and everything's a subtype of that. So I can use it as like a default bound, except okay. It's not actually the case when you have tuples.
That's correct.
But I think I can solve that by just having a different top type.
Okay.
So
one of the main things about tuples that is fundamentally different in the type system so far is that it's not an object type because it has no reference capability.
Yeah.
It has fields. Those fields have types and ref caps, but there is no R cap on the tuple. And that's interesting. Now, if we went and said you do have to put an R cap on a tuple, that would change a bunch of stuff. It would change stuff in the standard library. It would change stuff all over the place. It would change what it means to send a tuple as an argument to a behavior, for example. Like, when do you have a concept of a tuple being sendable, right? Does the tuple itself have to be sendable? Does all of its fields have to be sendable? Considering that we treat it as a value type, it becomes a little bit interesting. On the other hand, it would get rid of any kind of strangeness edge case in the type system to do that. So maybe we should do it.
So, Sylvan, here's a quick question. Something I was thinking about when I was filing 1767. Would it make sense to say that, like, a tuple has a ref cap that is implicit based on the ref caps of the elements within it, such that, like, if we go back to our table of viewpoint adaptation and say that, like, basically we go with the best ref cap we can pick the highest ref cap we can pick, the most the one you can do the most things with, that viewpoint adapts to or whose viewpoint adaptation includes the set of ref caps that that are in the elements,
right? So that if we have one of everything, that tuple has to be a ref. If everything in there is val or tag, the tuple can be val. If everything in there is val box or tag, that tuple can be box. That sort of approach.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking exactly. Yeah,
that is not crazy.
Thank you.
Hey, that's a pretty good compliment.
How does that work with generics though? Because
you would have essentially an inferred reference capability. And of course, under the system, you would have to be able to specify a reference capability if you wanted to, right? It wouldn't be that you were limited to it. It's just a question of what we would infer if you did not give it one. In much the same way, a class has a default reference capability that you can specify. So for generics, you do the same thing. So you take the full set of possible capabilities and pick the reference capability that would give you access to all of them. So it's quite likely for generics that your tuple would end up ref.
Yeah.
Not in the sense that you could mutate the tuple, because you can't assign to the fields of the tuple, but in the sense of that, because they're essentially all let fields, right? But in the sense that you could not, for example, send voltage because you could certain everything was in it sendable, which is the result that you get right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's a pretty good idea, Joe.
Yeah, and just kind of on that note, on 1767, can you just tell me real quick whether, like, which direction this is a bug in? Are we allowing something that shouldn't be allowed, or are we disallowing things that should be allowed? Because it definitely seems wrong that you can put a tuple as a type argument to a parameter that has no constraint, but you cannot do it to a parameter that has a constraint of any.
Oh no, there's actually a reason for that. That's not a bug.
Oh,
it's okay. Absolutely correct behavior. And the reason is, if it's not constrained by anything, then Pony does not have a top type. Like Paul is saying, oh, I'm using such and such as a top type. Pony does not have a top type, much like sure. C++.
Okay. So any is not a top type. Okay.
No, any is simply an empty interface. So right. It's something can only be a subtype of an empty interface, which could be any empty interface, right? You can invent as many of these as you like. You can say interface Bob and give it no methods, and congratulations, you have a new logical structural top type. It isn't a top type because it's structural typing. So because tuples are not actually under the hood encoded as objects, they have no type descriptor in that sense. So if you say, is this tuple a subtype of any, currently the type system will say, no, it isn't.
Right, okay.
Whereas if we treated them as objects with this thing that we're talking about, all of a sudden we could say, yes, it is. And we could even go further than that, and we could do things like play games with tuples where we say, oh, well, you want equality? Well, if all of the fields have an equality method, we can auto-generate an equality method on your tuple.
Right.
And now you can do things like say tuple equals tuple, and it will happily statically make sure that that's possible and build the right thing. So there are a lot of reasons why treating tuples as objects in the encoding is a good idea. There are some funny warts with it, though, right? Because right now tuples are always embedded. And if we treated it as an object type, we'd have to pay attention to what we meant by that. Did we want to say that means that tuples are always embedded? Or we want to say, oh, actually, we'd prefer to treat that as a reference type unless you say embed. But then, yeah, there's some funny cases there.
And I guess one more related question: why is it disallowed for a tuple to be constrained? Sorry, to have a type parameter constrained with a tuple constraint?
A type parameter constrained with a tuple constraint.
So you could say in this case, if I wanted to have a place where I wanted to say that this takes a type parameter of a two element tuple where each of those is any share,
right?
Where you do a colon tuple any share comma any share. Yeah.
Sure. The honest reason is that it's unnecessary and a pain in the ass to deal with at the type checker level, because anywhere you would do that, you can say that it's constrained on A, any share, and B, any share. And anytime you want to use a tuple, you say A comma B.
Sorta. Yeah. I mean, I kind of ran into a case where I was creating something that was a read seek A, where A is a tuple, and that's allowed because read seek has no constraints on A.
Yeah.
But I wanted to constrain the two element tuple to be of type any share, and it doesn't seem to be there's any way to do that.
I don't quite understand. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I had a custom collection type that I implemented, and it needed to return an iterator over A, but A had to be a tuple.
Well,
right, because I can't be
an iterator over A comma B.
Because that's not how iterator is set up. Iterator takes a single type parameter.
Oh, so you were writing a custom trait or interface that was doing this, as opposed to a concrete type. Am I completely driving you down the wrong thing?
We're out of time anyway, so we'll...
Okay. most of the time. All right, sounds good. We're well over time. Sorry, everybody. Thanks, as usual, for coming. Any last-minute stuff? All right, cool. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.